So I'm really interested in learning the secrets of success to people who have successful, long-term, happy marriages. So how long have you two been married?
51 years.
And tell us a little bit about how you met. Was it love at first sight? What made you decide this was the one I wanted to get married? Did you meet on a blind date? How did it all start?
Met in typing class in high school.
Remember typing on typewriters?
I used to write him love notes for my time typing, and he would do two time typings and turn them in, one for him, one for me.
But it was serendipitous because I wanted to take driver's ed in the second half of the school year. I had turned the age where you could take it in New York. And the principal, assistant principal in charge of these things, would not allow me to drop typing to take driver's ed. So I continued in typing, unhappily. But that's when we met, and really in the second half of that year. So it was all based on that decision not to
Wow.
let me take driver's ed that we're here talking to you today.
And
Wow.
the first thing at contact really we ever had was when he shouted across the typing classroom, "Hey, Roger, catch Stevie, she dyed her hair."
I deny
You did. And then the
that.
first time we went out, you had one of those Madras jackets, and you put your arm out, and I leaned against it, and you asked me if it was going to come off on the jacket.
Oops.
But married it anyway.
Had you dyed your hair?
Yes.
What color?
I made it darker.
So this was in New York, and you were both 16?
I was 16 and he was 17 when we actually started going out.
And then, did you take a break or have you been sweethearts forever without a break?
I wouldn't give him a break.
No breaks. We survived my going to college a year earlier, speaking almost every night by telephone and exchanging letters.
I used to write him multiple letters a day.
This was, of course, pre-emails and whatnot. So we stayed in close touch. She visited
Several
once or
times.
twice, yeah. And then she went to college up in Ithaca, New York, where
He was
I
at
was.
Cornell and I graduated in 3 years because we got married after my freshman year, so I had to catch up to him so we could leave together.
So you both went to Cornell?
I went to Ithaca College and he went to Cornell.
Were they in the same city?
Yes.
Yeah,
Oh,
both
Cornell is in Ithaca, New York. Got it.
on two hills, two different hills in Ithaca.
And how did your parents feel about this young relationship becoming so permanent?
Well, my parents couldn't wait to get rid of me, so to speak, because I had two older sisters and they had both gotten married at 19. My mother had gotten married at 19, and my parents wanted to move into New York City. We lived on Long Island, and so the sooner they got rid of me, the sooner they could move on. But when they saw that we were supposed to get married in January of 1970, and
Right.
when they came to pick me up at my dorm in Ithaca, I said, "Oh, see that apartment? That's where Alan's going to start living in September, and then I can move in with him in January." And they said, "We think you should get married this summer."
It was right down the block from her dorm.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we accelerated it and got married in the magical summer of 1969.
Oh, wow. My goodness. And what originally attracted you to each other? What did you like about the other person?
Well, there was a lot of
Raging hormones.
sexual attraction. That was good. And there was just cheerfulness on her part. She's always and still is the most cheerful person you'll ever run across.
And he is the deepest, strongest, caring person you could imagine. I have felt safe with him from the moment I met him. And we really knew that what we had was forever, because when he would drop me off my dorm, we were still, my freshman year of college, women still had curfews, and I had to be in by a certain time, but my dorm was on the ground floor, and I would sit in the car with him and cry because I had to go in without him. And then we figured out I could open my window, and he would come around and crawl in my window and hold me in his arms until I fell asleep.
Oh.
So he had to marry me because I could have been on the second floor the next year.
Right.
He could have hurt himself climbing in.
And so what did you study in university? What were your majors?
I was an English major, majoring also in education so that I'd be able to teach, which I never did.
I was a government major, but mostly in those days, majoring in political protest.
Right, we did a lot of that.
We would travel the East Coast on various protests and part of the movement, and Washington, D.C., and
New Haven, where we supported Bobby Seale.
Yeah, so, and local protests. But it was, formally, it was government that it was a good major, because then I went to law school at Berkeley following Cornell.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of protests, what have you seen that's the same or different in terms of, I'm really interested in youth movements, like against gun violence and for climate change. And then there was the whole Occupy Wall Street a few years ago. What have you seen in terms of similarities or differences in the recent protests?
Well, for me, during our college years, there was protest around all of the issues. The environment became a big issue.
Protests.
Not guns, no. Race relations, apartheid in South Africa, takeover buildings for various causes, the war, of course, in Vietnam. So that was just part of a student's DNA at that time. Then there was a big, as far as I could tell, hiatus in student activity.
We were complaining about that years ago.
Which was,
saying, where are the students? Depressing. Where's the outrage?
Even with our two kids, when they were in college at different places, our son went to Cornell and our daughter went to Wesleyan. And there was not that type of activity to any close degree. But, as we all know now, the activity has increased a lot of, our view, good activity.
Good trouble.
Good trouble happening. Maybe a lot of it starting with demands for equal justice on race relations in the universities that surfaced some time ago. And, of course, now with criminal justice issues, that's become more than just a university issue. So I think, what the difference is in those days and even before our sort of activities, there were identifiable leaders who really took the stage. And at Cornell, there were certain leaders that would organize things. Now, and you mentioned the Occupy movement, that was sort of the opposite. That was the of all that to the extreme. And you still don't see, I don't think, the degree of leadership in the Malcolm X or the Martin Luther King or the Bobby Seale, that sort of type of Eldridge Cleaver back in our day that was happening then in the current movement. Not that that's necessarily a bad thing, it's just a different thing.
I think the very big difference that I noticed, and it maybe because I was young when we were protesting all those things, but it seemed to me at that point that it was young people against older people. And the thing that I love about the protests now is how many older people are involved. You know, the 40, 50, 60, 70 people who are really into the justice thing. which, I mean, we used to fight with my, he used to fight with my father all the time, who would say, when you're older, you'll see, you know, and now I see that all us old lefties are in the protest and everybody in between, from the high school kids all the way up, which is, I think, a huge difference, and I think is going to make a huge difference.
Yeah, right. Remember they
can't
said...
can't be dismissed so easily.
You can't trust anyone over 30. Well, I don't know if that was Abby Hoffman, maybe, who said that.
I think that was.
But that's a very good point.
Yeah, it's true. If you go to a women's march or a climate march in Chico, there's all ages. And at the women's march, there's men, which I think is great, wearing pink pussy hats, you know. So
yeah, great t-shirt that says, this is what a feminist looks like.
Right. And I think another difference is this generation of protesters is very committed to diversity, equality. That's a kind of a spin-off of the No Leaders, but it's like, we don't care what your gender orientation is or your sexual orientation, and it's they're very fluid and interested in accepting of diversity. I think that's a difference, because
yes.
I think in the 60s most of the leaders were men.
Yes, true.
And Angela Davis.
And, yeah. Right. And then there were feminist leaders like Gloria Steinem, but they were leaders in the women's movement.
Right.
But even then, in the second wave of the feminist movement, being a media star or a leader was considered a no-no. So the women's movement probably influenced the current trend.
We'll take it.
What about having children? Because it seems that the hardest time for a relationship, a couple relationship, is when kids are born, because they're selfish. They don't care if they wake up every 3 hours around the clock and demand all your attention. So how did that change or affect your relationship to have two kids?
I think it made it stronger, if it could be made stronger. I mean, we both loved both the kids. The first one was easy as pie. She was just a dream child. She slept through the night from the day we brought her home from the hospital.
No.
She was a doll. Our son was Mr. Stubborn. But they were both delicious.
Yeah, we were so happy with them. And
we're still crazy about them. They're both in very stable, wonderful marriages that are a lot like ours.
Yeah, we moved to Chico primarily to be around one of them, our son, who's a professor at Chico State, and our daughter and her wife live in Tarzana.
And we can drive down to them instead of flying from Ithaca to Chicago to...
So, you know, we're here on the West Coast from Ithaca, where we lived prior to moving, because of them.
Uh-huh. And do you have grandchildren?
Yes, three.
Three, yeah. One up here.
She's 13.
With our son and his wife. And then two twins down in L.A. Who are 10 with our daughter and her wife.
And who was the mom, the biological mom of the twins?
Well, it was our daughter's eggs and our daughter-in-law's womb.
Wow. So
yes.
they did our AI. And then
yes.
Did they tell you where they got the sperm? I mean, how did they pick that?
I mean, they got it from a sperm bank, a very reputable sperm bank down in L.A.
Wow, that's really egalitarian. And all right, so their twins are really smart, I'm assuming. Well, they would be, but they're exceptionally smart.
Our granddaughter is exceptionally smart. Our grandson, we think, is very smart, but he is autistic.
Oh.
And doesn't speak. And he does have an iPad with a language thing on it, and he can, but he has no great desire to communicate unless he's hungry. In which case, he can get through every one of the pages to find exactly what he wants.
How interesting. Why do you think it is that they're more young people who are autistic now? Is it just because we know the word and can diagnose, or is there something happening that creates more autistic babies?
Well, I think there probably is a heredity component and it becomes stronger down the lines, but I'm no scientist. I also think absolutely that it's more often diagnosed. I mean, everybody had weird kids in their elementary school. There were always strange kids, you know, who you just wrote off as weirdo kind of kids. And it turns out probably most of them were on the spectrum, which is now considered a spectrum. You know, there's a big difference between somebody who has Asperger's or is somewhat on the spectrum and somebody like our grandson who is nonverbal at 10 years old and has several kinds of, you know, I don't know if he has cognitive problems. We have no clue because he lives in his own little world and sometimes he'll just start giggling and you know he's got something in there and you're dying to know what it is. We're very lucky because he loves to be snuggled and kissed and hugged, which is unusual for an autistic child or a child with autism. I don't think you're supposed to call them autistic. You know, it's delightful. We go to see, well, we can't go see him now because of COVID, but when we go, you know, we would be able to hug him and snuggle him. And the tighter you hold him, the more he likes it. And I always do this kissing thing with him where I'm always kissing up his back and then, now I need your elbow, now I need your other elbow, and it just cracks him up, and it's delightful. So we're lucky we have him, and it has shown us what incredible parents our daughter and daughter-in-law are. I mean, when you asked if we have kids, I think that we have four kids. We have two of our own and two in-law kids, and they're all ours.
Right.
Our son started going out with his wife when he was 17 and she was 16. Same as us. He went off to Cornell. She joined him a year later. I mean, the whole thing is the same. But she was like at one of ours because she was in the house from the time she was 16. And she didn't live with us, but she was constantly in the house from the time she was 16.
Right.
So we think of her as ours.
So what have your challenges been? None?
We've had a couple of health challenges, but we weather them nicely together. I had a heart attack in December.
Wow.
But I recovered beautifully. And, you know, I mean, little crummy stuff like that. But we've had no challenges in our relationship.
And were both sets of parents role models for you? I'm wondering what were the influences that you knew how to do a harmonious relationship so easily.
Your parents?
I'd say her parents were the role model side of things.
My parents believed, and this is, you know, you asked in your little email about advice we would give to other people, and we do give this advice all the time. My parents believed that marriage was not 50-50. It was 60-40 with both people trying to give 60 and only take 40. And we haven't ever, like, worked at that or been conscious of it, but that's very much our relationship is. I don't have to worry about what I'm getting out of it because he's worrying about that, and he doesn't have to worry about the same thing. And there are times that our relationship is more like 80-20 because that's what one of us needs. And then sometimes it just flips. But it's really, I think that the idea of a 50-50 marriage is just, it feels like you have to keep score.
I wrote a book called 50-50 Marriage, and I did one called 50-50 Parenting. But they would agree with you that it's not rigid. It changes over time. And, you know, like when the babies come, then things change. So it's a goal rather than a rigid criteria that we've got to do the same thing every day. But they would do things like list chores, divide them up, who's going to do this chore, who's going to do that. So how have you done the housework, the cooking and cleaning and cleaning up stuff?
Whoever feels like it.
Very fluid.
Seriously, whoever feels like it. I'm more a straightener, he's more a deep cleaner. So when he looks around and feels like it's not clean enough, he cleans. When I look around and things look messy, I straighten up. But we don't, it's nobody's job.
What about cooking?
Whoever feels like making dinner.
So does it, is it kind of like 50-50 in terms of who cooks and cleans up, or how does it kind of sort out over a month?
Who knows?
Yeah, it's very fluid. It could be different percentages in any given week or month.
We don't have jobs, or we don't have seats at the table. We sit in different seats all the time. So we really can't say, you know, it's your night to cook. It's like, I don't feel like making dinner. Do you feel like making dinner? Yeah, sure. Or do you want to call in? You know, I mean, we wing it all the time. There's never much of a plan. Except when I go like, oh, tonight I really want to make something or other. And then we do, you know. I hate to fall into male-female roles, but he often does the grilling if we're going to grill something, because I'm very careless. And so he doesn't let
That's
me near.
Safety factor.
Yes, it's a safety factor.
Sure, that makes sense. Stevie, did you work as use your English major, or what have you done in that arena?
I wrote 17 published novels. So I did use my English a bit, but right now I'm back to stained glass. I did, when we first were married, I did all kinds of, I worked at Mills College as the assistant to the dean of students, and then when he was in law school, I was a legal secretary for a law firm, and then we came back to New York and I had my babies, and then I did all kinds of crafts, and then I got into stained glass. Oh, when Asa was really little, because he cut himself down in the glass studio.
Right.
So then I did stained glass for quite a while, and then I stopped and wrote the 17 novels, and now I've gone back to glass.
She's collapsing a career of great accomplishments in that, including in the stained glass area, having an important piece, a stained glass dollhouse, a large stained glass dollhouse, fully furnished in the Museum of the City of New York, which is famous for its dollhouse collection. So she's been quite accomplished. The bicycle that's in the background here is a bicycle with stained glass in the wheels, and she's done wheels in bicycles, wheels outside of bicycles, and all sorts of 3D.
And he fixes up the bicycles.
Yeah, I'm the cleaner, or, you know, getting them ready, but she specializes in 3D works of stained glass that have been sold in Chico, in New York City. She's installed many, many pieces in apartments in the city, etc. So, yeah, they sandwich her book career with the stained glass.
Clearly, he's my biggest cheerleader and the man who has allowed me and assisted me in doing all of this.
Well, it's important to value each other's work. I think that's a key feature of a long marriage. You have to value what the other person is doing, whatever it might be. And in this case, you've heard a little bit about, you know, what she does.
And do you practice law? On what kind?
I did. I practiced trial work, litigation work in the New York City area. Then I worked at Cornell in the HR field, doing investigations of harassment, discrimination, Title IX, policy work, labor relations work, things like that. And then, I guess almost 4 years ago, I retired from Cornell. My last position was holding the place as the dean of students. I wasn't really the dean, but they were the dean had left, and the new one was being recruited. So they asked me to sort of step in, which was a great way to end the Cornell career, interacting with students directly on mostly positive things rather than all my investigations and work that I did. So, so that was the last thing that finally retired, and here we are. I do teach at the Cal Northern School of Law. I teach a course there, and the rest of our work here is volunteer.
Let me just ask you as a footnote. Cal Northern has well over 50% pass rate for students who take the bar, which is really high. I'm just curious why they have such a high pass rate, the students.
Well, that's a good fact and an interesting question. This is my second year teaching. I'm also on the Board of Trustees, so we do review, you know, questions around that. There's a really high quality of teaching going on. People who teach, generally speaking, specialties that they practice. We have a judge who's teaching trial advocacy, for example. And the students are all adults. They're working. They have decided they want to be lawyers or they want a JD degree, and they've got to pass the bar. So they are concentrated. It's not sort of like I was. My law degree was sort of a postgraduate degree, right, from undergraduate to the next degree. These are people who have been out of undergraduate school, maybe a graduate school, and really want to be lawyers and are dedicated to it. And also we spend time teaching in a way that will permit them to succeed at the bar. There are courses for review and things like that. Part of the enrollment entitles them to a very good bar review course by a company called Bar Brie, which is part of their tuition. So I think that all gels into a high pass rate.
Interesting. And roughly what percent of the students are female lately?
More than 50%. I don't have the exact figure in my head, but it is more than 50%.
Yeah, that's interesting. Stevie, to go back to your novels, what genre? Do you do historical fiction, contemporary, horror?
The ones that I did for HarperCollins, some of them were time travel, and some of them were historical romance, and one contemporary romance. And then I did light murder mysteries.
And when you're writing, some writers of fiction say that the characters, after a while, speak for themselves. So you're just kind of channeling.
Oh, God, never. They just, I was writing one novel, and the hero would not do what I had planned for him to do. And I was like, you have to do this. And then it was like, he wouldn't do it. I know, he wouldn't do it. But I often used to wake him up in the middle of the night and say, did you know it wasn't Sloane's baby? And then go back to sleep. And in the morning, I'd say, what brilliance did I have last night? And he'd say, it wasn't Sloane's baby. And I'm like, oh, thank you, and go on. But he's very good about waking up in the middle of the night and remembering what I said.
Oh. Now, she, to your point, she had voices all the time talking to the characters, definitely talked to her.
Banging in my head saying, make me happy, make me happy.
You have to have the black, what they call the black moment, in order to have a successful romance novel. So they wanted to get past that.
Yep.
Do you, take a book that comes to mind, and how did you, did you think intellectually, left brain, I'm going to have this conflict with this, and it's resolved in this way, and here's the plot line, and it's in this setting, in this century, so it's an intellectual start, or how does the process begin?
The characters start telling me what to do. I'm very manipulatable, apparently.
From the very beginning.
From the very beginning. I mean, I would come up with the basic premise. This is a woman who has had to raise all her siblings because her parents died, and the last thing she wants is to raise anybody else's children, and the hero has two little girls. You know? So there's the... I mean, you have to have a heroine worthy of succeeding, a hero worthy of the heroine, a conflict that keeps them apart, a circumstance that brings them together or keeps them together, a black moment, a monkey wrench, and a happy ending.
Your marriage didn't have the black moment or the wrench.
My marriage has had no black moment and no monkey wrench.
So you just have to be very imaginative to create them.
For the books, as long as you start with that sort of premise, and I came up with a lot of, I think, very emotional premises, the characters just fill it all out, and you just... You think all the time, would she do that? Would he do that? You know, and
These are award-winning books. I mean, these are ones that people, we call them page turners. If you give somebody her book, they don't start reading it if you expect to go to sleep at night or something like that.
Oh, that's what you told Stacy and I forget his name, the guy who worked for you. They took it on their honeymoon.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, you also did those murder mysteries. Didn't you plot backwards?
Yes, I plotted backwards on the murder mysteries. I knew who did it, and then I had to go back and figure out how that happened. Those were fun. They were very light. They took place on Long Island. I think the tagline was, "Life on Long Island can be murder." And
what's the most foreign historical setting that you've done?
All the historical ones were in the Midwest in the 1890s, except the one that was in Oakland in the 1890s.
And why the 1890s? What interested you about that era?
You know, I don't honestly know, and I don't believe in past lives or anything like that, but I've always been drawn to things from the 1890s. What is that? Okay. I like old, we found Annie's shoes in some antique store, one of my characters. We found some kind of bicycle that one of the little boys in one of my books wanted. I'm just drawn to them in antique stores. We used to, or right now we live in a 1902 Victorian house here in Chico. But all the furniture that we had in the last house was all heavy oak, late 1800s kind of furniture. I'm just very drawn to that. And I just, for no good reason at all, I know how they preserved food and I know how they got around, and it came very naturally to me, as did the characters.
Well, you have to, because the readers who are dedicated and know the period will write you if they find a flaw in your...
If you have the wrong length sleeve on a woman's dress, in, like the Georgian period or something, the books get flung across the... wall because they're incorrect, but I didn't have any of that problem. The only problem I ever had was somebody's children from an earlier book. I had the wrong name for one of them. But
well, that's kind of appealing that they kept track of such detail of your work. I mean, that's very loyal.
Yes.
Oh yeah.
Yes.
Very loyal readers.
The funniest thing that ever happened with that sort of thing is I did lots of book talks in various places, and I think I was in Oconomowoc, Wisconsin for a Romance Writers of America conference, and I was in a bookstore, and they had a group that had read all of my books, and they were talking about one of my books, and I disagreed with one of the readers, and she said, "Well, if you read the book," and then realized what she was saying. I read that one, yeah. But I had loyal, wonderful, kind readers. It was wonderful.
We did have a pretty magical, maybe past life experience
in Oakland.
In Oakland, trying to remember the deal. We went to San Francisco
for one of your cases.
For a case I was handling, and we had dinner.
I had just finished the courtship.
She finished the courtship, and we had dinner at a restaurant that had old maps.
Fire maps, I think.
Fire maps that of the city, including Oakland, that showed all of the houses in the late 1890s and where they were so that they could be reached. And we saw that there was a house located
exactly where I put it on Lake Merritt.
On Lake Merritt in Oakland. So
wow.
We said, well, wouldn't that be interesting? So we drove there the next day.
We must have rented a car.
And we find this Victorian house right where she had put it, the last surviving Victorian house
that
on.
That had a high room, which I had described in the book. Without having seen that.
Oh, and much of the house was the way
right.
that she had described
and
it.
In the book, it was owned by an attorney who had, I think it was two sisters, not two children. Yeah, he hadn't had children. And this was now, that house was changed into the historical society there. So we knocked on the door and we said, can we see the house? I just wrote a book that takes place at this exact location. And she said, sure. And we go in and she leads us into the conservatory, which is Maine in my book. And then she says, it used to be owned by an attorney.
Oh, wow.
He was like, I can't take this anymore.
So they started selling her books at the Historical Society.
Traditionally, romance novels were bodice rippers, and there is like violence. You know, she resists, and he sweeps her into her arms, and she submits, and she really loves it. So, uh-huh. Has that
mine
changed?
No,
mine
no.
aren't those.
She's a sweet romance.
I write very sweet romances.
Has that changed, or do people still buy those kind of bodice rippers?
People still buy those books, and there are many writers who still write those books. Virginia Henley was quite famous for those books. Mine, I would fight with the editors who would say, can't they kiss now? And I would say, no, they're in the middle of a public street. They're not going to kiss now. And they'd go, well, now can they kiss? You know. So, yeah, mine were very sweet.
Do you have an agent that approached?
I don't write anymore. Now I glass.
You ran out of things that interested you, or why don't you write them still?
Because the publishing industry has changed so very much. There used to be gatekeepers, and you had to be published by, I was published by HarperCollins and Dell, and Harlequin had a special line called Next, which was for a more grown-up reader, and I think I'm forgetting one of the people I was published by, but and they did all the publicity. And they did all the getting your books in the stores and stuff. And then ebooks came in and people started publishing their own books. And then they started selling 10 books for 99 cents. And there wasn't much point financially in writing the books anymore. In addition, you know, you can have characters, at least I can have characters in my head for just so long before you feel like it's all homework. You know, I have to go write this because my characters are miserable. I have to get this done. You know, I have to fix it for my characters. And the only way I can say is I grew out of it. I had enough. I was finished and ready to embark on something that I could finish in a much shorter amount of time than a book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, the books took months. So, you know, you got a bunch of pages done every day, and I was a very fast, very prolific writer. But I wanted to be done with the burden of, you know, the character. And it was never from the publishers. They were always, you know, willing to wait, and I never made them wait at all. But the characters would just be like, I want to be happy now. And I'd be like, I have to go back to the computer.
Right.
So,
how do you keep romance and, you know, pizzazz alive over a long-term relationship? How do you make it so it's still interesting?
She's always, I mean, proof of the romance in her are those books. I mean, she just has a great feel for the romance, more than I probably naturally have, but it's contagious. And So we have that sort of magic all the time. She's always, as I say, cheerful, enthusiastic is part of her nature.
And he's so stable. He's so very stable.
That's right, I'm stable.
You are, you're stable. But I think, you know, in a 50, and it's a longer than 51-year relationship because that's how long we've been married, but we dated for 3 years until we could get old enough to get married. We have either one of us fallen more in love with each other from time to time. I mean, I have loved him enormously throughout all of those years, but I fall in love with him again over and over again, and it's new over and over again when it just sort of comes over you how much you love this person.
Yeah, and you do say sometimes, you know, you've fallen in love with me. About me.
Yes.
Say, why are you so in love with me?
Yeah. What happened? How come suddenly you're so in love with me?
Right.
And it's a magical thing. There isn't any root to that. It's not that he's bought me something or said something, or I can just wake up like that. Maybe it was a dream. I don't know. But it just comes over you. For me and him, anyway.
The couples that I interviewed for 50-50 Marriage and 50-50 Parenting said after they had kids, to keep the romance alive, they needed to leave the house, like go on a little trip or, you know, have a date night or something. But staying at home in domesticity kind of was deflated the romance sexuality part.
Took the kids with us.
Yeah, we didn't have a date night, but we always did travel quite a lot. And that,
but the kids came with us.
The kids came with us, and we continued that. I mean, we had lots of trips from New York to the place like the Caribbean and Europe and other places.
For our 45th anniversary, we went to Africa. And for our 50th anniversary, we went to Australia.
Those
are very magical, romantic times.
So, yeah, I do think that. It wasn't so much getting out of the house, though. I don't think we ever felt that. We were very happy in all the houses that we lived in. And it's
but it was something new.
Something new, yeah.
New, that's the key, yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to find new things. I mean, it's hard to find something to talk to him about because now we're together pretty much 24/7, and there isn't anything that happens in my life that I can tell him about because he's right there. So travel really has been wonderful for just looking at things new and different with each other.
Mm. Also politics, because every day I'm astounded at something that Trump does. Really? He did that? So that kind of discovery of abominable acts keeps things interesting.
We're trying to rein that in because it's
in.
Too.
He gets very upset when I start screaming at the television. It says, you know, you should turn it off. You're getting very upset. You should turn it off. But, you know. But we agree on politics completely. So we have, you know, I mean, when we got married, we were students. We were babies. And, you know, we were painting flowers on our jeans and I was sewing him dashikis and we were going to all these protests. And then he got a job. We went to law school and he got a job as a lawyer and we became sort of corporate. And he left every day in a suit and tie. And I became sort of like a corporate person's wife. And then, you know, each stage of our lives, we've paralleled each other beautifully. We just go right along with the flow to whatever it is we are now. And now we're retirees, I guess.
Mostly.
You're artists and teachers.
We're artists and teachers. And that dovetails very nicely. I help him figure out how Zoom is supposed to work and let him do his work while I write almost 4,000 postcards to voters. and then, you know, for my glass, he helps install things. He helps get frames ready. He helps get bike frames ready. I mean, we're into each other's stuff.
What about religion? That can be a real bond that holds a marriage together.
We don't really have any. I mean, we were brought up, well, he was brought up more Jewish than I was. I mean, he had
bar mitzvah confirmed, but we haven't practiced
any religion.
Brought that into the into our world.
I mean, my parents were Jewish, but they were not practicing Jews. So
they're more of a Jewish culture than a religion.
Yeah, I mean, I do.
We do Passover, Seders.
Which we didn't this year because of COVID, but we would.
I mean, we've done them every year for forever.
Yeah, we like the traditions, and we like the foods.
Hanukkah traditions and things like that.
Yeah,
the dreidel, the Hanukkah bush.
Play dreidel
with our granddaughter and her parents and. They're good friends, one of whom is German, and the exchange student who was living here who is German, and we figured, and Carolyn and Heather, we figured out there were more non-Jews at the table playing dreidel than Jews.
That's what global culture is like today. What about your when your kids were growing up, if they asked, you know, is there a God, what's the meaning of life, how did you approach spirituality with the kids?
We didn't. We just believe in being good for good's sake. We're virtuous people, and we don't need a reward at the end, and nobody is looking down from the heavens. You're just good because that's how you should be, and that's how our kids are.
I don't know. It kind of sounds like you're an evidence of reincarnation.
My sister says that I am an old soul. She's very spiritual, and she does hypnosis and stuff like that. And she said, I tried to get hypnotized once. I was I tried to get regressed because I was writing a book that didn't wind up getting published, which was a time travel, and it involved regression. So I went to a hypnotist. Because my sister lived on one coast and I lived on the other. And he tried to regress me. And he went through this whole long thing. You're going down the stairs and you're blah, blah, blah. And then I finally said, maybe I should tell you nothing is happening. And he said, I think it's that I'm a new soul, not an old soul, right?
He said you were a new soul.
He said, do you like the color purple? I said, yeah, sure. You know? And then he said, I knew it, you were a new soul. And then I called my sister and I said, it didn't work. He said I was a new soul. And she said, well, anybody who looked at your palm would know that. So apparently I'm a new soul, not an old soul.
I don't really believe that. I think we're all old souls, or we wouldn't be in a human body, you know, as sophisticated as you are. But anyway, if there was karma, what would you say brought you two together, what you've learned together or worked out together? Or was it just to have fun?
I think I would use the word I used before, sort of serendipity. I mean, that whole thing about meeting in high school.
Yeah, I mean, you shouldn't really find a love that would last this long when you're 16 years old, for heaven's sake.
Right.
How did we know the people? We didn't know the people we were going to be, never mind the people our partners were going to be, you know?
Yeah, you have to grow together
and we were
when you start out that young versus meeting later when you've already established certain things.
Who you are, you know? We weren't anybody when we met.
So we grew together and are still doing that.
What are your astrological signs?
I'm an Aries, and he's an Aquarius.
It's the age of Aquarius. Is it still?
I think it's over.
That's impossible.
You can sing it anyway, honey. You can sing it anyway.
That would be horrible if it was over. But
no, I don't think it's over. I think it's coming. Is there any other suggestions you would give to like a couple who is just getting married that we haven't talked about that you think, I'd really like you to think about this and this?
Yes. Be considerate of each other. People in relationships tend to be nicer to the outside world than they are to their partners.
Yeah.
There's nobody I am nicer to than this man, and nobody deserves it more. I mean, I think before I speak, how is he going to take this if it's some minor criticism or if it's something that's bothering me that I know it's going to upset him when I tell him it's bothering me, which has nothing to do with him. It's, you know, I haven't told you my toe hurts or whatever it is. I think about how he is going to take it before I open my mouth. And I think that that is really a smart thing to do. Mm. And he, thank heavens, is deaf to some of my outbursts. He just knows if I go off for some unknown reason because hormones are playing or whatever, he knows to just let it be, let it be, let it be, and then I come back and I'm fine. So he knows how to handle me very well.
Yeah, there's a related thing on that note, which is, I would say, the no blame.
Oh, that's
thing.
True.
It's very important that everybody take responsibility in the relationship for everything that happens. And, you know, it's we and it's our. And I know it's the old thing you hear in high school sports. There's no I in team. But the notion that we're all responsible for everything that happens without blame is, I think, critical.
Yeah, we notice a lot that we don't blame each other for, you know, small little things that most couples would, you know, you left the thing out, you. growing up, my father used to say to me, how important will it be in 5 years? How important will it be in 10 years? And there are times that I actually do that exercise before I open my mouth.
Yeah, I do that. I do that with students. You know, I tell them things that I've used that many times.
Yeah,
we haven't really found anything important enough to argue over.
So what keeps it interesting? If there's no little tensions, what keeps it interesting?
Well, look at that smile. Wouldn't you be interested?
Yes.
That.
I don't know. I find joy all around me all the time, and then I share it, and that seems to suffice, right?
That's the key.
We are so incredibly lucky. I don't believe, as I said, in God or anything, so I don't believe in, you know, like blessings and that we are blessed. But in terms of counting my blessings, I am so grateful for our whole life. We just have had and continue to have a magical life. It just has been such a ride.
How wonderful. Great. Thank you.